Hi everyone, I'm Debbie Roberts from Property Apprentice. Join us today for the Week in Review, where we talk about current events for the everyday investor and home buyer. I've got five topics for today. The first one is an article published in OneRoof on the 8th of May. 1 in 22 homes bought since 2017 are at risk of negative equity, so we'll unpack that as part of our conversation. Second topic was an article published in OneRoof. Auckland Council received 7,100 objections to the new CVs, so we'll discuss that one in a bit of detail. Topic number three was on Stuff on the 10th of May, which housing markets are most exposed to the coming interest rate storm. There's a headline for you. And topic number four on interest.co.nz on the 11th of May, Westpac says Auckland's housing shortage will be gone by the end of 2023 and another 4 or 5 years for the rest of New Zealand. So we'll have a bit of a chat about that. Topic number five, an article was published that said Wellington has staggering increase in homes for sale in April, according to Trade Me Property. All right, so let's discuss. And feel free to let me know your feedback. And if you've got any other topics for suggested podcasts in the future, please let us know. We're always open to suggestions. So the first topic for conversation is the OneRoof article from the 8th of May. 1 in 22 homes bought since 2017 are at risk of negative equity. Figures from Velocity showed that 1 in almost 1,000 properties bought in the last 5 years are currently in negative equity, putting more homeowners at risk should property values decline further. Velocity senior research analyst Wayne Shum said their analysis found that just 0.11% of Kiwi homes purchased in the last 5 years are in a negative equity position, but if property values drop by 20%, the percentage of homes in negative equity will increase to almost 5%, which equates to 1 in every 22 homes bought in the last 5 years. I'll stop you there. So first of all, I don't know anyone that's expecting property values to drop by 20%. I certainly don't see what we're going through as a crash. This is more of a correction caused by, you know, massive increases towards the end of last year. So a lot of that was the fear of missing out, you know, lots of competition from other buyers, limited listings available in the market. And now we're going through a bit of a correction because lending criteria has tightened up, number of different reasons which we've discussed previously. So yeah, I'm certainly not expecting a crash in house values. This is a correction, if anything. I'd be really surprised if property values drop by 20%. That being said, you need to be careful as to what statistics you're looking at, because what we often see in the media, they'll report median values or average values, and sometimes that can look quite scary. So, you know, just remember it's the house price index that is the most accurate reflection as to what's actually happening in the market. And the house price index from Real Estate Institute in New Zealand is certainly showing a lot less of a decrease than what a lot of the averages and medians are showing, which is to be expected, you know. So yeah, check out, I'm sure I've done a previous podcast about the difference between medians and averages. Check that out. And if I haven't done one, send me a message and I'll be sure to record a bit of a subject around that for you. So according to this article, Auckland at 0.27% and the West Coast at 0.42% have the highest proportion of properties bought since 2017 in negative equity. The least number of negative equity properties are in Gisborne, Nelson and Taranaki. A decrease in house prices can also lead to a contraction in consumer spending, according to the Reserve Bank's Financial Stability Report. Negative equity occurs when the value of the real estate property falls below the outstanding balance of the mortgage used to purchase that property. So in other words, the value's less than what the mortgage is on that property. It's usually caused by falling house prices or when properties are purchased with low deposits or a combination of those two things. Shum said that the increase in interest rates and inflation will mean that some homeowners will have lost a portion or all of the deposit that they paid. So he said if property values fall by 10%, just over 1% of Auckland's homes purchased since 2017 will be in negative equity. And if properties drop 20%, the proportion increases to around 6.5%. So according to him, first homeowners and buyers of apartments are most at risk because apartments saw slow price growth over the last 5 years. At present, about 2% of apartments purchased since 2017 are in negative equity, but if property prices drop by 20%, this might increase to 20.18%. For those looking at selling, negative equity can mean that the outstanding mortgage becomes larger than the value of the property, so sellers might need to fund that shortfall. Sometimes the banks won't release the title for sale. It can make refinancing more difficult, and it can also trigger additional costs such as low equity premiums on any new loans secured against that house. Shum said that those who bought properties after the end of the first COVID lockdown in 2020 should have benefited from strong equity gains that have provided a buffer against price drops. So Mortgage Lab Chief Executive Rupert Goff said that as long as you're making mortgage payments and are not planning on selling, negative equity shouldn't be a problem. And in my opinion, that is the smartest quote in this entire article. So, you know, at the end of the day, you don't lose money in a falling property market unless you sell that house for less than you purchased it for. So if values drop down, don't panic, just keep paying your mortgage. You know, talk to your mortgage advisor if you're struggling with that, and they can see if there's anything that they can do to help. But as long as you don't sell for less than you paid for it, you're not losing a thing. Okay, so just ride it out. And remember that the downturns tend to last a lot shorter in duration than the recovery and the boom. So, you know, we're certainly not expecting this to be a long drawn out downturn or anything like that. Okay, so second topic for discussion, we've got a One Roof article where the Auckland Council received 7,100 objections to the new CVs. I shouldn't giggle when I read that. So, because obviously, if someone's taken the time to write a letter to council, they were worried enough about it that they did that. So, objections are considered to be an important part of the revaluation process because some changes meant that the estimates would not always be right, and this could impact the amount and rates owed. So Auckland Council Valuations Manager Chloe Woolard said that of the 7,100 it received, 3,913 were complaints about the CV being too low, and 3,178 were complaints about it being too high. This number represents only 1.2% of all of the CVs issued, and it's lower than the number of complaints received in 2011, which was 2.23% of the CVs. We've certainly been working hard over the years trying to explain to people that the council values or rateable values, if they're called that in your area, or government valuations, they're different, they're called different things across the country. But yeah, essentially, it's not an indication as to market value. So you should never base your estimate for what a property is worth on the government valuation or CV or RV, because it's not an indication as to market value. I mean, even in Auckland, when the latest results were released, they were actually locked in months before, you know, so there's no way that you should have expected that to be an accurate indication as to what the current market value was. CVs generally only get done once every 3 years anyway. So, you know, at the point of issue, some of them might be right, some of them might be above value, some of them might be below value. But certainly you don't rely on that to being an indication as to market value. The four-year time lag between the valuations in Auckland was due to COVID, and that saw Auckland's average CV rise 338,000 or 32% to 1.41 million. Some locations, including Omaha, which is to the north of Auckland, and Otara in South Auckland, saw their average CV jump more than 50%. So among those who objected were 130 property owners who agreed with their overall CVs but disagreed with the value that the council had assigned to their land and improvements. and there seemed to be some confusion with what the improvement value of the CV meant. So just to provide a bit of clarity around that confusion, Woolard was quoted as saying that the improvement value was the difference between the total CV and the land value and didn't reflect the cost to build or replace anyone's actual house. As a result of the value of land significantly increasing, the improvement value decreased in a number of areas. She said there's no certainty when all the objections will be cleared, as the valuers will be going through locations systematically. Most objections would not be settled in time for when the new rates were introduced on July 1st, but Auckland Council would adjust it if the valuation changed. James Wilson, who's the head of valuations at One Roof's partner, Velocity, said that the relatively low number of objections could be due to property prices increasing significantly in the past 4 years. Wilson said that the relatively even split in the number of objections between too high and too low was reassuring because it's a sign that the process was well done. According to Wilson, relatively low number of objections could also be seen as a result of more people accepting CVs as a tool for rating purposes and that other tools are available for determining a property's worth, which is great because that's exactly what I was explaining before. It's not designed to be an indication as to what your current market value is. Okay, so it's a determination that the councils use to work out how much to charge you in rates. In our experience, if you get a lower than expected CV, that's something to celebrate. So the only time that people really should be starting to worry a little bit if they've got a CV that's come in much lower than expected is if they're planning on selling in the near future. And in that situation, you can always get a registered valuation, because registered valuations trump council valuations every day of the week. Nobody that does council valuations comes around and actually has a look inside your house, do they? Whereas registered valuers do. So they'll see all the renovations that you've done. All right, so if you want to learn more about the property market and investing in general, then join me at one of our free beginner's guides to property investment events. We run them online, so you can join in from the comfort of your own home. We also hold them in person in our office in Ellerslie in Auckland. So go to propertyapprentice.co.nz for our upcoming dates and register for one today. Topic number three, we've got a Stuff article published on the 10th of May, which showed, which headline was, which housing markets are most exposed to the coming interest rate storm. This article was originally published in The Economist, and it takes a look at some housing markets around the world, including New Zealand. So it made for some quite interesting reading, just to help keep things in perspective with what's happening around the world. So homes in America and Britain are selling faster than ever. House prices in Canada have soared by 26% since the start of the pandemic. The average property price in New Zealand has increased by 46% since 2019. But again, like I said, that's the average house price can now set you back more than $1 million. It doesn't mean that every house is $1 million. So borrowers from the UK have enjoyed low interest rates for over a decade, but last May 5th, the Bank of England forecasted that inflation could reach higher than 10% later this year, and they'll be increasing their policy rate to 1%. So America's Federal Reserve has had increased its benchmark rate by 0.5 percentage point and hinted that more tightening could follow. Investors expect the federal funds rate to rise above 3% by early 2023, which is more than triple its current level. So obviously in New Zealand, we've got the OCR as a comparison, and that's on the increase now as well. Most central banks in the global north, which is the rich and powerful regions like Europe, North America, and including Australia and New Zealand, which is a little ironic, they're starting to press their monetary brakes to try and slow down inflation and things like that. So many economists agree that a scenario similar to the 2008 global financial crisis is unlikely, which is important to remember. We're not expecting another major financial crisis. And the reason for that is because lending standards have improved. In New Zealand, we've got a responsible lending code that all of the lenders, all the banks have had to comply with ever since the global financial crisis. Many household finances have become more resilient as well. So among the housing markets under observation, property prices are being strengthened by high levels of net household wealth, strong labour markets and strong housing demand. But the rising cost of money could make homeowners' existing debt more difficult to manage. So, you know, this is where rising interest rates play a part. And certainly when you couple that with inflation, it can make things a bit more difficult. So it could discourage some buyers from applying for loans. Australian and New Zealand property values are so sensitive to moderate rises in interest rates. So having said that, prior to the global financial crisis, the housing market in New Zealand didn't really start slowing down until interest rates hit about 8.5%. So, you know, having said that the property values are sensitive to modest rises, I don't 100% agree with that, because most of New Zealand tends to fix their interest rates for a period of time. So any increase in interest rates tends to have a bit of a delayed factor, you know, but it will have an impact on the number of people who will be looking for houses. So alongside price levels, three other factors influence housing slumps. One of those is the number of homeowners with mortgages versus those who are mortgage-free. Secondly, the number of variable-rate mortgages versus fixed-rate loans. And thirdly, the amount of household debt. So the number of homeowners with mortgages versus those who are mortgage-free around the world, the larger the number of homeowners with mortgages, the greater the impact the rate rise is going to affect the market, obviously, right? Denmark, Norway and Sweden have got some of the world's highest shares of mortgage holders due to their relaxed lending restrictions in response to the pandemic. In Sweden, tax breaks for homeowners and a dysfunctional rental system have urged people to secure mortgages. In Norway and Sweden, housing loans make up more than a third of banks' total assets. In Denmark, they account for nearly 50% of the lenders' books. This puts the Nordic banks in a bit of a risky position. In contrast, some Central and Eastern European countries such as Lithuania and Romania, they've had high mortgage-free home ownership levels since the 90s. Housing was extremely affordable back then, and Southern Europe countries such as Spain and Italy have also had high levels of home ownership because it's common for families to inherit or help spread the cost of owning property. The number of variable rate mortgages versus fixed rate loans, rising interest rates will be felt most instantly, like I said, by the borrowers on variable rates as opposed to the ones on fixed rates. And that can fluctuate with changes in policy rates. For those on fixed rates, the pain's delayed. In the US, it's common to have mortgage rates fixed for, wait for it, 20 to 30 years. Can you imagine being able to lock in an interest rate for 20 to 30 years? How cool would that be when interest rates are low? It's not all roses, though, because you've got to realize that if you're selling or, you know, if you're switching banks, for example, you could have some significant break fees to pay if you're coming off a higher interest rate and going to a lower interest rate. Whereas in New Zealand, the maximum term at the moment is 5 years across the board. It's not as significant as if you were fixed for a 30-year term paying break fees. So it's same within Canada. Mortgage rates tend to be fixed for 5 years or more. But on the other hand, lending in Finland is almost entirely done at floating rates. 4/5 of Australian mortgages are tied to floating rates or variable rates. And just looking at the proportion of borrowers on fixed versus variable rates can be misleading. In some countries, mortgage rates can often be fixed, but for a period that's so short, you know, too short to protect borrowers from the interest rate storm. And in New Zealand, fixed rate mortgages make up the bulk of the existing loans, but nearly 3/5 are fixed for less than a year. And so New Zealanders tend to chase the cheapest rate going, and often it's the one-year fixed rate. So, you know, it's not necessarily the smartest strategy over the long term. In Britain, nearly half the fixed rate stock is for 2 years. You know, they're fixed for 2 years with their mortgages. The amount of household debt. During the global financial crisis, when house prices declined, households with large mortgage repayments relative to their incomes were struggling the most. At present, households are richer. but they have incurred more debt than ever before. An example is Canada, where its citizens have added $2.8 trillion to their savings during the pandemic, which pushed their net wealth to $12.2 trillion US, but their demand for homes meant that household debt was 137% more than their income. The share of new mortgages with extreme loan to income ratios, in other words, exceeding 4.5, has also risen. So obviously in New Zealand, we've got a lot of places where the ratio between the prices and income levels exceed 4.5. So the share of mortgages in Canada has risen, which is prompting Canada's central bank to issue a warning about high levels of indebtedness. In most countries, demand still vastly outstrips supply. Strong job markets, millennials entering the market, and a shift to remote working have raised the demand for more living space. New properties remain scarce, which will sustain competition for homes and keep prices high, as opposed to expecting any major drops in values. In Britain, there were 36% fewer properties listed in February than at the start of 2020. In America, there were 62% fewer listings in March compared to the year before. Nor is the alternative to owning a home, which is renting, particularly attractive. You know, across Britain, average rents were 15% higher in April than in early 2020. And in America, they rose by a fifth in 2021. So, you know, obviously in New Zealand, we do have some significant challenges in the housing market, both in the rental side of things, as well as for homeowners looking to enter the market. But across the board, I would just like to remind you, the system's not broken. You know, we certainly don't have a bubble in the New Zealand housing market. The underlying demand is still there. It's the reduction in demand at the moment is because of the difficulty to get lending. It could get a little bit easier when the amendments to the amendments of the CCCFA, when that comes through, which is expected next month. But then on the flip side, with interest rates on the increase, that does mean that the lenders here will be increasing their test rates that they test your affordability at. So that can make getting lending a bit more tricky as well. All right, fourth topic for today, the interest.co.nz article published on the 11th of May. Westpac says Auckland's housing shortage will be gone by the end of 2023 and another 4 to 5 years for the rest of New Zealand. So, you know, at first glance, that headline looks a little bit scary. So I'd just like to remind you that they're talking about the shortage being gone. We're certainly not talking about being in an oversupply situation. So according to Westpac New Zealand's latest economic bulletin, it'll take a considerable number of years to correct the balance between housing supply and demand, despite signs that the current shortage is starting to improve. Senior economist Ranchod said that New Zealand's population increased by about 11% between 2015 and 2020, but over the same period, housing stock increased by only 7%. While the shortage in housing was felt most intensely in Auckland, this has since spread across different regions, with the number of people per dwelling rising strongly over the last decade. A lot has changed over the last couple of years due to the COVID-19 pandemic. You know, obviously, border closures meant net migration gains, which had averaged around 60,000 people a year, turned into a net loss of 7,600 in the year to February, while the number of new homes being built increased to record levels. The report estimated that the housing shortfall has been reduced by about 30,000 homes over that period, so down from an estimate of a shortfall of 75,000 homes pre-pandemic down to about 45,000 now. Although the shortage has declined, there's still a way to go in order to restore the balance between supply and demand. Ranchod said that New Zealand needs to build around 130,000 new homes per year to address the shortfall and cover for the needs of a growing population. He said, we're looking at a period of rapid home building as the number of dwelling consents issued has doubled in the last 12 months, but the lack of materials and labour can slow the pace of housing development completion. The Westpac report says that net migration flow will be temporarily negative as Kiwis will want to travel abroad after the pandemic, but in the long term it will return positive as migrants start entering New Zealand again. However, it's likely that changes to immigration rules will probably see that net migration numbers remain below previous highs, probably well below previous highs. Aucklanders felt the most impact of more housing stock and lower migration. The report estimates Auckland's housing shortage has fallen from around 35,000 homes at the start of the pandemic to about 15,000 short now. In other regions, the relief from housing shortages is more subtle, as population growth has not fallen to the same extent as Auckland. The report concludes that the shortage will likely be eliminated in the next 4 to 5 years across the country, provided that high building levels are sustained. So what we tend to see is when the housing market slows down, new developments start to slow down as well. So, you know, it does tend to sort of balance itself out. The reason that Auckland was more affected by the increase in supply and not the same increase in population is because the majority of new migrants to New Zealand, stats show about 60% of new migrants to New Zealand settle in Auckland. So, you know, when the borders are closed, that has a massive impact on the population growth in Auckland. We'll wait and see what happens when the borders open again and we start getting immigrants coming back into New Zealand. But yeah, 15,000 short is certainly a lot more stable than 35,000 short. Right. So, just our last topic for today. On the 11th of May, Wellington has staggering increase in homes for sale in April, according to Trade Me Property. Wellington region saw a staggering increase, like I said, according to the latest Trade Me Property Price Index. The number of properties for sale has jumped to 39% in April, which is the highest on record. According to Trade Me Property Sales Director Gavin Lloyd, every other region except for the West Coast experienced an annual rise in supply. Hawke's Bay had an increase of 85%, while Manawatu Whanganui had an increase of 86%. Lloyd said that the usual pattern for winter was that market supply would cool off, but this hasn't happened lately. With a surge in supply, buyers had plenty of options and had more time to do their due diligence before purchasing, which is great if you're a buyer, right? Less competition in the market, more listings to choose from. Great if you're a buyer. Not quite so much fun if you're a seller. He said, as a result, in some regions, we're starting to see the property market enter a stalemate situation where buyers simply aren't willing to pay the price sellers are asking and they're at a standstill. Despite more housing supply, demand dwindled last month by 4% year on year and 14% in the month prior. Canterbury, Gisborne and Manawatu Whanganui experienced record high asking prices last month. The national average asking price, and I emphasise the average because this is not house price index to give you an indication as to what's happening with property values. The national average was $968,500 in April, which marked an increase of 19% when compared to April 2021, when the average asking price across the country was $152,650 less. Okay, the Wellington region had an average asking price of $984,450 last month, which is a 16% year-on-year increase and a drop of 1% compared with the month prior. Even with a supply surge in the region, demand only grew by 4% year-on-year. In comparison, the average asking price in Auckland was $1,248,600. In April, which climbed 16% year on year and dropped 1% month on month. Supply in the Auckland region was up 30% year on year in April, while demand dropped 11%. Nationwide, houses with five or more bedrooms had the largest price increase in April, with the average asking price up 22% year on year to $1,654,150. And for one or two bedroom properties, the average asking price rose by 20% to $690,100, while the average asking price for three or four bedrooms also rose 20% to $986,400. The largest jump in average asking prices for townhouses, which increased by 18% in April to $884,950. Now, this highlights, in my opinion, something which is quite unique to when you're looking at the averages. So, you know, one of the things that we know is that a lot of the new builds that have been developed recently have been townhouses. You know, a lot of them have been townhouses. And we've all heard about the inflation in building materials. We've all seen the rapid increase in house prices in the new build market. So the fact that the average asking price for townhouses has increased is no big surprise, considering that, you know, there's a whole bunch of brand new ones compared to existing ones that are now being sold. Okay, so and with the inflation, like I talked about, no surprise that the average asking price has increased. Doesn't mean that all townhouses have increased in value. All right, so that's it for the week in review. I hope you enjoyed today's session and stay tuned next week for another review. And we've also got another podcast. So stay tuned. We'll look forward to seeing you at the next one. Thanks for listening.